Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Irene Lee about Project Guts. Guts is growing up thinking scientifically. Right now, I'd like to welcome Carol Barton. She is a paper engineer, teacher, book artist, and curator, and she runs Popular Kinetics Press. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you. I love your work. And Diane Karp joins us here. She's the executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute and is hosting Carol, who's going to be teaching a workshop called Pop-Up Structures and Sculptural Bookbinding, which happens all this week. Welcome, Diane.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Good morning, Carol. And good morning, Santa Fe.
And good morning, Ireland.
Good morning, Ireland. That's right.
We have listeners in Ireland.
There.
We have listeners on Bear Island, Ireland.
I think you must have
they
listeners
stream
everywhere. You have listeners on Mars.
Yeah, the Martian contingent hasn't really weighed in yet, but the Ireland
they
has, and happy St. Patrick's
not,
Day.
Right. They tend not to.
They're
vote
wearing
those
red
Martians.
Today.
That's right.
So, Carol Barton, you make pop-up books and other works of paper engineering. I think many of our listeners know what a pop-up book is, but maybe not everybody. What is it?
Well, a pop-up book is very sculptural. You open the page and something dimensional comes off the page. And my books are not commercial. They're made as art pieces. So I'm using pop-ups as sculptural elements within these artist books.
There is a magic that I think most people who open these things experience, which is something comes alive and it feels very much like life. It feels like an animal or plant or building is suddenly growing up.
It is like that. I mean, here you've got something flat, it looks totally two-dimensional. You open the page and something surprising just comes off the page. It bounces off of the page.
How did you start doing them?
I studied painting, and when I moved to Washington, D.C., I was with a group of artists that were doing artist books. They offered me the chance to do an artist book. They gave me a grant. And that first book didn't have pop-ups in it, but it did have die-cut windows and doors. So every page had a cut-out window that led into the next page or back into the page before that. And the die-cutting process is integral to making pop-ups. It's the way pop-ups are cut out and produced. Die-cutting is actually sort of taking a cookie cutter to the page, cutting out the part, and then the parts still have to be hand-assembled. So from the die-cutting process, I got very interested in the structure of the book. A friend of mine found a used pop-up book dating from the 1900s called, it was an Italian edition of Sleeping Beauty. And when you opened it, the entire thing opened into a circle and was completely dimensional. And I was fascinated by that book. So from there, I began going down to the libraries in Washington, D.C., and looking at the historic collections in the Library of Congress, in the Smithsonian's Historic Library, and found all sorts of amazing early books and was very inspired by them and began doing my own books based on those.
So this pop-up books have existed for at least a century.
Oh, pop-up books, there are two aspects to this. There's the overall category called movable books. And movable books are the earlier of the genre. They involve the viewer doing something to the page. They don't automatically spring open. So, for example, there might be a wheel that you have to turn or a tab that you pull. Those books actually go back to the 1300s.
Really?
The earliest I've found was in the Getty Museum. It was a volvelle or a turning wheel of the moon. So as you turn the wheel, you see the phases of the moon. And that book is not even on paper. It's on vellum.
Wow.
The pop-up book began to appear in the 1850s, and those are the books that actually do have the parts that spring off of the page. So they have been around for about 150 years.
And so they rely on the artist doing cutting and gluing and a whole lot of planning on how this thing can fold into a 2D space and then become 3D.
They're very mechanical, and the people who do this are called paper engineers. It really does involve engineering, but you're using a very simple material. Still, you're learning the mechanics of it, and it's one of the reasons I think this is such a great thing to use within the schools, because it teaches kids a lot of things that they're not learning otherwise. Mechanical skills, dimensional design, trying to visualize things in space, and most importantly, trial and error problem solving.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And I would think that there's so many different kinds and textures and weights and so on of paper that each one has different properties and you can use them in different ways.
Yeah, and that's another thing. There's no set paper to use. So that's another trial and error part of the process, trying out different papers and seeing which one works for that specific application.
We're talking to book artist and paper engineer Carol Barton. So one thinks of these books as primarily for children, but of course they're not. I mean, you do these incredibly creative things. They're for, I don't know if you'd say children of all ages or just anybody.
Children of all ages is a good description. But an interesting thing that's happening within the industry now is that within the past 2 years, there have been a whole new market of books coming, of pop-up books coming out really directed at an adult audience. There was a pop-up book of wine connoisseurship.
I think I saw the pop-up book of neurotic phobias or something like that.
Mm-hmm. The pop-up book of phobias and the pop-up book of nightmares by Matthew Reinhardt. Great books.
Yeah, do not leave these on a low shelf for the kids to find.
Well, I use them whenever I have to teach a high school class because the high school kids really relate to them. They're edgy, they're quirky. A lot of the kids can relate to the psychoses.
Right. So, what does it take to make them? You show on your website some very simple folding and cutting techniques where you can, in about 1 minute or 5 minutes, make a little smiling creature that opens when you open even a card. You can make like a card for your friends or your parents.
It takes about 30 seconds. The simplest are just cut and folded into a folded page. And you can do it very quickly. One cut or two cuts and a fold gives you a pop-up. The page works like a lever. A pop-up has to work over a fold. So that's the mechanism that makes it rise and fall. And so you're cutting into the fold of the page to get this mechanism to lift and drop. And it is, again, trial and error. So you cut, you know, fold, try it, and then keep adjusting until you figure it out.
This medium, this genre, I guess you would say, has come a really long way in probably the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. What are some of the more unusual things that you've seen? I mean, didn't I see one which was a whole entire nuclear explosion that happens when you open a page?
Yes, there was that.
It's a little dark.
A little dark. There are some very edgy ones coming out on the market. Graceland came out about 2 years ago. It shows all the rooms in Elvis's house.
Now I have to ask, does Elvis move his hips in a paper-engineered kind of way?
I have an earlier one of Elvis moving his hips, and the back of the book has a sound chip in it.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's another element that you have also added is other sensory inputs. For example, you've got one that has it's towers, paper towers, and there are little tiny light bulbs or whatever, or LEDs, and you open and the tower lights up from within.
I've actually got it right here.
Hold it up to the microphone.
Okay, here it is. It's a rather large volume. It's about 9 by 12 and about 4 inches thick. It's bound in a dark midnight blue cloth, and when you open it up, you see prints of Italy that I brought back, maps and illustrations of landscapes in Italy. Now, we're sitting in the light right here, so some of the effect is lost, but your viewers are listening, so they can, in their imagination, turn off the lights, turn down those lights, and what you'll see are panels that are translucent, and there's a light behind the panels so that the text is glowing in the dark, and you can read this entire book in the dark. Then, as you start paging through the book, you'll come across, interspersed within the text, white pop-up towers. The first one is a lookout tower, and it's sitting on top of a map of Liguria, because this is about Italy. The second one, it is glowing in the dark.
And you open it's amazing. You open the page, and it just rises into the air, and then you turn the page. It goes back to sleep in another tower, this time with a church and a bell tower.
Right. I like that idea, back to sleep.
Yeah.
The center one is a fortress, and then we've got a lighted lighthouse.
I wish all the children of Santa Fe were here right now watching this. It's a little hard to convey on the radio.
Well, the last one is probably the most spectacular. I call it the Vanity Tower. In early medieval Italy, especially in Tuscan towns like San Gimignano, everyone was trying to build a higher tower than their neighbors.
So that was the way they expressed their competition.
Right. It gave them status within the community, and I guess if there was an altercation with your neighbor, you had a strategic advantage if you had a higher tower.
You'd go up to the top and throw meatballs at
them. Exactly. This one also is glowing in the dark, but it has a ring of fiber optic filaments around it, and that creates a little halo of stars around the top.
Wow.
Then if you turn the lights back up, I'll show you the mechanics behind it. There are two AAA batteries in the back, a little very bright flashlight bulb, and a reed switch, which is a glass magnetic switch. There's a magnet embedded in the cover, and when that magnet hits the switch, off the light goes. It's just like your refrigerator. Really, the light does go off when the door is closed.
This is something that you probably want to give to kids with somewhat better developed small motor skills, because otherwise they're going to destroy these incredibly delicate and rather fragile works of art.
I'm always really careful around kids. They love these, but I usually am just showing them with a young audience. Mainly they're bought by museum collections, and they're shown within the various museum collections across the United States.
And book collectors as well. Mm-hmm. There are book collectors who collect nothing but movable books, and I have one in my collection because my late husband was a physician, and we long ago, almost 40 years ago, bought him an 18th century anatomy that had little flaps that moved and little flaps that slid to reveal the layers of human anatomy. Mm-hmm. That was apparently a typical teaching tool.
Very typical. The earliest I've seen of those go back to the 1400s.
That's right.
There's a whole collection in the National Library of Medicine in Washington, D.C., of those early anatomy books. Yeah. That are just spectacular.
Absolutely. So, I mean, besides being beautiful and engaging and entertaining, sometimes pop-up and movable books have had a real working sort of purpose.
Now, it seems that you would have to make these and at least assemble them by hand. Is there mass production in this particular genre of book?
There is, and it is. The die cutting is done by machine, but the final assembly is all hand assembly. I just got back from China on Thursday, having my second how-to book printed, The Pocket Paper Engineer. And they do hand assemble them. It's very much like an auto assembly line. Everybody has a tab to glue down or a piece to position. And by the end of the row, a page is finished, but it is handwork. And it does follow the global market because of that.
And so you assemble them in China. I know somebody who used to do them in Colombia.
Right. Colombia, South America was a big assembly plant, and then the work moved to China. Now, that's my commercial book, which is the how-to series. The artist books, like the Tower book we just looked at, I do the assembly work, so I'm very aware of all the hand labor involved and appreciative of that.
And how many do you make, for example, in a series?
I've done rather large editions for an artist book. 600 was the most, so there's lot of handwork involved.
Wow.
I like that, though, because it's time that we've sort of lost in our society. We used to have a lot of handwork within a day's labor, ironing and washing and all of those tasks that were very ritualistic in a way.
Or you'd quilt all winter.
Right.
Well, Well, actually, my friend and author Miriam Sagan, who's been on the show a number of times, wrote a brilliant essay about why she always has enough time, and she attributes it to, besides not having a work ethic, she attributes it, and not watching television, to the fact of doing things like washing and ironing and hanging up your clothes and cooking without a microwave.
Mm-hmm. It's a relaxing experience, and as you're doing the handwork, which is satisfying, your mind is freed up to think about other things. So I think it's very meditative.
When you work and you're making an edition of 600 books or 200 books or whatever, do you have music? Do you have the radio? How do you?
I have the radio on all the time.
Public radio, no doubt.
Absolutely. And music on occasion, and sometimes I'm just in the quiet thinking about the next book I'm going to do.
There's a wonderful book I saw on your website called Plant This Book.
That was done, I was in residence in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and there was an old seed company there. They were still using the seed packets that they'd printed in the 1940s and 50s, and so I gathered up a lot of those packets. Undid them, sort of split them apart, sewed them into the book as pages.
Did they still have seeds in them?
I took the seeds out, then glued the seeds back in them once they were bound into the book. So as you turn the pages of the book, the seeds sort of rattle in there, and it's also got an auditory element to it. I haven't planted one of them, though.
And the whole front cover has seeds all over it, so you feel like, you know, when the apocalypse comes, you really do plant this book.
Right. I was just reading about a place, I believe it's in Russia, where they're stockpiling seeds from all over the world.
Well, it's actually a scientific center, mm-hmm. And they have seeds of all the different plant types, so that if there should be, you know, a blight of a particular type of wheat or corn or whatever, they can go back and they can use the seeds to figure out how to develop an anti-blight line of that plant. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I love that aspect of book arts. The nexus of science and the book arts, I think, is such an interesting one. In fact, I'd curated at one point a show with the Smithsonian called Science and the Artist's Book.
Right. One of the things that's going on right now is there are a lot of physicists that are using pop-up books and the mechanisms, mm-hmm. and engineering behind it to take that move from two-dimensionality into three and move it from three-dimensionality into four. And so they're looking at all of these books and all of these processes very carefully, mm-hmm. to try and figure out how one would use that leap to move into the next dimension.
They're finding that proteins are actually folded just like paper is folded.
Yes.
And so they're learning a lot about protein structure through origami and pop-up structures.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I know a physicist back in Philadelphia who's doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Carol Barton, paper engineer, teacher, book artist, curator, and she runs Popular Kinetics Press. What are you going to? You're going to be teaching Monday through Friday, today
right.
through Friday.
Today through Friday.
That's a long time to be able to start dealing with paper. What are the tools? I mean, obviously, you're going to be doing die cutting. People are going to be working with little paper knives,
X-Acto knives,
and ruler.
Mm-hmm. X-Acto knives, rulers, bone folder, which is a folding tool made out of cow bone, glue, scissors. The tools are pretty basic.
And all the tools and materials are supplied as part of the workshop. And if anyone is interested, there's still a couple of spaces left. And scholarships.
I'm interested.
Come.
I wish. The You also obviously work a lot with color, you being a painter by training, so that's another part of it. Do you feel that these books are, the ones you make, are they narratives in some way? Do you tell stories?
Definitely narratives. And that's another reason that I love using the pop-up book within the classroom. It gets the kids storytelling. Immediately they start thinking of stories to go with their pop-up illustrations, and it's especially good for kids that have more visual skills than verbal. It sort of moves them into the verbal skills and the literacy part of the process through the visual process.
Do you find they make a lot of insects?
Lots of insects, lots of hearts. My neighbor teaches at a nursery school, and she just had her 4-year-olds do pop-ups from the how-to book, and she gave him a choice between hearts and crowns. Most of them did crowns.
Well, crowns are more like bugs than hearts
right.
are.
But we see bugs, hearts, what else? Lots of cartoon characters show up. Room interiors
right.
is another favorite subject.
What about food?
Food does appear, not as much as some of the other elements, but definitely hamburgers and fries a lot.
Now, where does book arts stand? Where do book arts stand in the art world? It seems like it's sort of a subculture that's all mm-hmm. off by itself in the corner.
It's a growing subculture, and it's a very new one if you look at sort of the whole range of media. It grew out of the 50s and 60s. A couple things generated it. One was that the printing process was changing right then. We were going from the old letterpress, like Ben Franklin had, that had originated back in the 1450s, to offset printing, which is a photographic process. And the old letterpresses were being taken to the dump. So artists, being the great scroungers they are, were pulling those presses out of the dumps into their studios, and the old technologies were being used newly as art processes. So that was one of the factors involved in the new artist book movement.
Very
and the other was happenings back in the 60s, because there was no physical product really, it was ephemeral. People were documenting the happening art projects with catalogs and with books, and so that was another aspect that sort of generated the artist book movement. So it is
there's
a new
also,
field.
There's also something which is interesting, which is the react. I don't know if this is exactly right, but it seems like there's been since mid-century a kind of reaction to the art world and museum world, where people go and stand and look at big paintings, whereas this is a very intimate, handheld, one-on-one, you and the artwork. You have to actually interact with it. It's actually pretty hard to show in a museum because you can only show one page of it.
Exactly.
And you also can't let everybody touch,
yeah.
whereas this is about touching.
It very is a much about handling the materials, about having it right there in your hands, and it is very intimate, which is one of the reasons that people just love it, because it's right, very physically in your presence.
And artists have made artist books forever. The idea of a journal or a sketchbook has transformed over the years, and is this wonderful window into the way the artist thinks. And the other processes that fed into this were the development under Martha Wilson at Franklin Furnace of supporting artists to make artist books mm-hmm. and collecting them. And that whole collection is now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's part of the museum's collection of artist books. And if people want to buy artist books, there's a place in New York City called Printed Matter that's part of the DIA Foundation that supports and markets, basically, the artist book and gives half the money of every book that's sold back to the artist.
Mm-hmm. Carol Barton is an artist, teacher, paper engineer, pop-up bookmaker, curator, and she runs Popular Kinetics Press. She will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute this week, today through Friday, teaching a class, a workshop called Pop-Up Structures and Sculptural Bookbinding. You can call the Santa Fe Art Institute at 424-5050, and you can find them on the web at sfai.org. And Diane Karp is the executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, and we're delighted to have her here. And you can also go to popularkinetics.com to see more work by Carol Barton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about teaching young people to think scientifically. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Irene Lee. She is the principal investigator for Project GUTS, which stands for Growing Up Thinking Scientifically. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, this is a program for young people based in Santa Fe.
That's correct. We started in Santa Fe. Our sponsoring institution is the Santa Fe Institute, and we're funded through a grant from the National Science Foundation Academies for Young Scientists program.
And so how do you go about doing this? How do you teach young people to think scientifically? Like, what do you do when you go into a school? Do you send teachers in?
Well, first of all, we have a summer program, and we recruit throughout the various elementary schools and middle schools to get a cohort of students available who would be interested in summer workshops. And during our summer workshops, we teach three things. We teach basics about complex systems, some fundamental concepts that kids can understand and hopefully be able to identify in their environments. We teach students how to do basic computer programming to make their own computer games that sometimes integrate these complex systems. And we have the students meet scientists, interview them, get to know them and their research, so they have a better feel of what it is to be a scientist.
So what does it actually mean to think scientifically?
Well, for me, we hope the students come away with the ability to look at the world and ask questions and be able to come up with different ways they might go about inquiring more deeply. One of the things we teach is how to model systems on the computer. And through this modeling, they can run what-if scenarios that maybe mimic what they see in the world. And they can change variables. They can have this experimental testbed within the computer. And then later, maybe have some suggestions on how to fix a problem. So for example, some of our students just got done with a pollution unit. And they were looking at pollution in their neighborhoods, in their schools. We went out to Gonzales Elementary, and actually saw where trash was accumulating and where their trash bins were. And we can model that on the computer and have these agents stand in for the people. And the agents will walk around the environment and pick up trash or drop trash. And you can see over time where trash accumulates based on some simple rules.
Simple rules being like which way the wind blows?
Yes, and also maybe there's some agents that are litterers who go around and just drop candy wrappers every three steps. And then there are others who are just cleaners who pick those up. And given some ratio of cleaners to litterers, we can see over time where trash accumulates and if trash accumulates.
Now, something you said a moment ago, thinking scientifically is about asking questions, but it's about asking specific kinds of questions.
Correct. Questions that we can answer through some data we collect. So the ultimate goal for these students would be to have models where they're generating data as well as collecting data from the real world about where trash accumulates and comparing the two and seeing why or why not the model reflects what we see in the world.
And that's exactly what they do that's what global warming scientists do.
That's correct.
They make a model for how things are going to be 5 years from now, and then 5 years later they look at it.
Right, but unlike some of those models that try to be predictive, to know exactly what the world's going to look like in 5 years, perhaps. We're looking for trends. We're looking for patterns, not necessarily the same degree of, how should I say, realism as in what you'd want for a global warming model.
So what are some of the kinds of projects besides the trash one that young people are getting engaged in?
There was one early on epidemiology, and it became for many students the study of contagion. And contagion could include how the common flu spreads through the school, or it could be how gossip and rumors spread. They interpreted it many different ways and could customize it to reflect some things they're interested in.
It's very interesting when you compare, for example, in the example that you just gave, you've got something which is about germs, bacteria, viruses, whatever, spreading through a population. That's one thing. And then you have something which is human-created, namely gossip or stories.
Correct.
That seem like they should be very different, but sometimes it turns out that things like that work very similarly.
Correct. And the students are able to see that there's some underlying mechanism where there's contact between people, there's a probability that the idea or the disease spreads between people. And then based on who those people know, what their networks of connections are, the spread could be explosive or it could be very limited.
There's also a rich opportunity for metaphor in that.
Yes.
Where, you know, if the young poet scientists are probably going to be thinking about how gossip spreads like a disease.
Right. And we encourage that.
Do you?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Because it's such a different, I mean, metaphorical and poetic are such a different way of thinking than analytical scientific thinking. Or at least it seems so on the surface.
Mm. Well, I would say that we encourage students to see patterns across many disciplines. One thing we're aiming for is to not teach science as in this is biology and this is chemistry and this is physics, but to see some themes that cross various areas.
What are some of the themes that cross various areas?
What that's being studied at the Institute by Jeff West, who I think you spoke with a couple weeks ago, is scaling phenomena across different content areas, whether it be the human body, whether it be cities and streets and arteries. Call them arteries there too, huh?
Yeah.
But there are rules that govern the branching and the flow of whether it be cars or blood through a system.
Or why a mouse's circulatory system is the way it is and an elephant's is the way it is.
Correct. And in cities, the analogy would be why city streets are laid out the way they are and how large cities can grow and what are the economies of scale within a city.
And when a small city grows into a large city, why the downtown streets just don't work very well.
Right. Correct.
We're talking to Irene Lee, who is with Project GUTS, Growing Up Thinking Scientifically. So it's a summer program and then an after-school program during the school year?
Correct. We also have this after-school program currently in 8 schools in Santa Fe. Students come to the Project GUTS Club 1 day a week after school, and the programs vary between 1.5 hours and 3 hours in the afternoon based on the school day at that particular school. And there are clubs that meet, and they cover units over the course of about 4 meetings. And the units we're doing this year are epidemiology, emergency egress, which is how to escape, basically, emergency evacuation, traffic jams and traffic
emergency
flow.
Evacuation out of buildings, out of cities?
Out of buildings, particularly. One thing we do in Project GUTS is we try to ground the science in things kids can observe in their environment, either at their school, their neighborhood, their home. So when we studied emergency egress, we often dealt with the school or the classroom. How
right.
do you get out of classroom, given
right.
there's furniture and whatnot, or a school auditorium or a gymnasium.
Or second floors, of which we don't have that many here in Santa
Correct.
Fe, but second floors of buildings.
That's right. Some of the other topics were traffic jams and traffic flow. Pollution and ecosystems is our final unit, which we're studying now.
And that, when you study pollutions and ecosystems, you're really getting into complex systems.
Correct.
So how do you explain, both to your students and to our listeners right now, the phenomenon of a complex system?
Okay. A complex system is a system made up of many independent parts, and those independent parts have rules and simple behaviors. When you have all these units together, sometimes you have phenomena, you can observe pattern and emergent behavior that would not be predictable just knowing the individual behaviors.
So one example of that would be mob psychology.
Correct.
You've got lots of perfectly nice people, then they come together and they do something they wouldn't have done on their own.
That's right. Another would be termites, maybe building mounds. We often cite birds flocking, how there may not be any one leader in a flock of birds, yet by a number of simple rules it's been shown that you can generate flocks of birds, at least on the computer.
You can generate flocks of birds. But it is very interesting and almost magical when you make this set of rules and then you can generate a visual that looks so much like nature that you're really taken into the illusion.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things that draws students in. They're used to playing video games and having so much visual input from the media. And when we show them how to create computer models through programming, they're learning these skills, but at the same time, they're viewing themselves as a player in a world that looks much like a three-dimensional video game at times.
There's a lot that's been written about and discussed about how video games and television and so on are not really that great for children in terms of other skills really atrophy. Here you are also teaching them computer programming, computer modeling. How do you see the kids who are in your program right now? I mean, are they behind? Are they ahead of the game because of the video games and media that they've been exposed to?
Well, that's hard to say. I think the world is changing, and the video games are becoming more ubiquitous, as are 3D simulations that scientists use, huge data sets, and gorgeous simulations. And that education is changing, science is changing, so in such a way that I wouldn't say that it is detrimental at this point. Of course, I believe in...
Is it positive in some ways?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. I think the ability to understand what you're seeing, the ability to program, allows a student to know something from the inside out. So maybe understanding a model from how it was created as well as how it looks. And being able to insert oneself into a simulation as an agent and see the world from that perspective. So say you've made the simulation of a flock of birds, but then you can be one of the birds and experience the rules and the behavior from the bird's point of view. I think that's very powerful.
Now, do you also have young people going out and digging in the dirt and things like that?
Yes, yes. Actually, our next field trip coming up, we're going to the El Dorado Reserve. And as part of our unit on ecosystems, they're going to be out at the preserve and looking for evidence of interaction between animals and animals and nature. So hopefully what they find can later inform some of the models they're building.
We're talking to Irene Lee of Project Guts, Growing Up Thinking Scientifically. There's a lot of freedom and curiosity that young people have. Do you see them sometimes coming up with fresh ideas that the grown-ups around them hadn't thought of?
Yes. There's some very simple models that they can make that have really surprising results. For instance, there was this one model one fellow generated this summer where there were different kinds of Lego men, and one type of Lego man, when they ran into the same kind, its same kind grew larger. When it ran into another kind, it canceled that other kind. And the other breed of...
And these are real Lego men, not computer Lego men.
These are computer Lego men. And then there are other kinds of computer Lego men who had other rules, whether they met another Lego man and they grew or shrunk or whatnot. And they just put them in this virtual world and had them run around. And as they met each other, something surprising happened. There would always be one that became huge and dominant, and the others just fell away. So if you looked at the scale of their sizes, you would see this long tail phenomena that we often see in complex systems, where, say, there's one corporation like Microsoft that becomes the big
giant,
and then there are many smaller, and the number of smaller increases.
Very interesting.
Right.
And so this is a computer model, and it's a corporate model. Is it also a natural model? Is it something that you find in animal populations, that particular phenomenon you're talking about?
I'd have to think about that more. There probably are some instances of that. I'm thinking of forests.
Forest seems to be a different kind of example where you've got lots and lots of tall trees together.
Right, but at one point there may have been many saplings of the same size, but ultimately only one could grow to become the large one, where the others...
In a particular area.
Right, correct.
Very interesting. I think another thing that's great about young people learning science and technology is, for example, when computers were first introduced into the classroom, a lot of kids did everything they could to make them crash. And I mean, I know I've got a close friend in California who lives in the Bay Area, and he's paid good money to try to make computers crash, and he debugs them.
Right.
But these kids just do it out of, I don't know what, some kind of spirit.
Yes, yes. I haven't run across that too much lately.
It might have been the first few generations of because computers have been in the school for quite some time.
Sure.
And they weren't very good. So making them crash wasn't very hard.
Right, right. But then again, it's this mindset of trying to figure out how something works. And if you can't figure it out by taking it apart, maybe you figure it out by breaking it, right?
Exactly.
So it's another type of learning.
So has this program been in place long enough where you can track young people's career paths and educational paths after they've been in the GUTS program?
Not yet. We are only in our first year. We started working with students just last summer in June. We're coming to the close of our first full program year, and we'll start again this coming June with a second cohort of students. So it's still in a very, very beginning phases. We have had positive results. What students had to say about what they learned during the summer was fantastic, that they learned how to do things they never thought they would be able to do. For them, that was computer programming, making video games. Some of them were talking about new concepts, new ways of looking at the world that they had never thought of before. So we can see growth. We haven't had enough time to do a longitudinal study that will follow them 5 years out and see how many of them were really impacted by this program. But we hope to do that.
And it's hard to say. I mean, I've mentioned before on this program my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Chappett, who had us doing science and Shakespeare and all these things in the fourth grade. And I don't think there's any way to track that, but it completely transformed my life because we were out digging in the dirt and we were taken to the observatory and observed the rings of Saturn one night and, you know, all these things that you don't usually get to do. And it fires not only your imagination, but really your confidence in your own ability to think and do stuff.
Right, right. And we see that with students' feelings of self-efficacy on the computers. You know, they think they can figure out how to do things once they've had a few successes. The risk-taking they do in their computer games and the programming, you can see that.
Do you think that risk-taking then bleeds over into other areas of their lives?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Very interesting. So you recruit people into this program. What are the criteria that you use to recruit people?
The only criteria is interest. We take students from, you know, those that are highly engaged in science and school and those who aren't. The only criteria is that they want to be there and they're able to be there.
And do you end up getting an equal number of boys and girls?
Well, it was interesting. This summer we had almost an equal number of boys and girls. We had three different sessions. The first was co-ed, the second was all girls, and the third was all boys. And we filled them.
And that was just coincidence?
No, we actually planned it that way.
Oh, okay.
We know we wanted to have an all-girls and a co-ed. The final workshop was initially set out to be, bilingual English-Spanish speakers, and it would be taught in both languages. But I think what happened was out of the population of students who were interested in our program, we had most of the girls attending the second session, which left boys for the third session.
How did you get into all of this work yourself? You studied mathematics and then you went into education.
Correct. And between mathematics and education, I was involved in computer graphics in New York, and then I moved into the computer game industry in California. So my interests have always been visual and visual arts, visualization connected with mathematics. And I made various attempts to try to align those two in a career. There was an interest in architecture early on and design, and then the 3D computer graphics, followed by the gaming. It came together, gosh, must be several years ago now, as an interest in using visualization techniques to help students understand math and science concepts.
And so, are you doing the teaching yourself?
I do some of the teaching myself, and I'll be teaching this evening.
And, let's talk about that. Right, we have, this is all part of the, I almost forgot, this is all part of the Science Cafe series. Tell us about what you'll be doing tonight.
Yes, tonight we will be exploring complex systems through games and computer models. We'll have a short introduction and talk just the way we are about what are complex systems and what are some characteristics of complex systems. And then we'll be engaging the audience in some games and simulations. The first one is a kind of a standing up, moving around the room. The second one will be using Palm Zire, mini handheld computers, to play a game in which we beam information back and forth between each other. And lastly, we will be looking at some simulations of ecosystems together and trying to find these points where we can have a balanced ecosystem that that stays persists over time.
And this is the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, and it's today from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe, and it's sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science and the Santa Fe Institute and the Santa Fe Public Schools, Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, all sorts of folks. And it's free, and youth ages 13 through 19 will get a seating priority. So why 13? I mean, there's a lot of people who get interested in science, and in fact, you know, choose their careers in science at a much younger age than that.
Correct. And the students in Project GUTS are generally a few years younger. They're middle school students rather than high school students. At this talk, we're addressing a wide audience. Hopefully, there will be some high school students and maybe some parents and younger students will be there as well. And we can talk about some programs that the Institute offers for those a little bit older.
What kind of programs does the Institute offer?
There's one called the Summer Internship Mentorship Program, and that's a pretty elite program for high school students. Six students are selected to spend the summer with the Institute. We have some instructors who teach them agent-based modeling. They get to attend the first week or two of the Complex Systems Summer School, which SFI holds for graduate students and researchers throughout the world. So it's a very great experience for the young people. And then they choose projects that they want to work on independently with a researcher as a mentor for the next 4 weeks.
And that's something that I would think would really set them on their life path.
Yes, yes. Get exposed to some things that other students may not get until they were seniors at the university, right?
How do you think, I mean, you've been observing this for some time, how do you think science education has changed since you were a young person coming up?
Interesting. I think there's a lot more opportunity to get involved at a younger age. The thought of doing research as a middle school or a high school student wasn't available to me, even an option. I think we're getting students involved in research at a younger age and in inquiry science, and also looking at how it impacts their communities. How can they give back to their communities through science?
I was wondering also, I loved science when I was a kid and sort of was thinking of going that direction and didn't eventually as a career thing, but I was wondering how what we learned as young people has actually changed and been outdated and it has been swept aside in the last, 20, 30 years. Are they still learning about atoms in the same way? Is the knowledge that people were taught in the 60s and 70s out of date now, or are they still teaching the same kind of thing about what the atom is, what molecules are?
I think in general that change is very slow in public schools and in curriculum. There is a huge opportunity now to update what we learn and how we learn, to integrate the sciences and also integrate technology into how students learn about science. We see at a global level that the science now has three legs rather than two. It used to be experimental science and theoretical science, and now there's this whole new genre or branch having to do with computation and what scientists learn through running models and using computers to analyze huge data sets and mine data and so forth. And we have an opportunity now to show students at a younger age that this might be the future. So it's a time of change. It's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Irene Lee is the principal investigator for Project GUTS, Growing Up Thinking Scientifically. How do people get involved in this project? Let's say somebody's listening and they want to get their student and their child involved, or a young person's listening. Can they join now, or do they have to wait for the summer program, or how does it work?
They can go on our website, excuse me, www.projectguts.org, and they can apply online. They can ask to be part of our mailing lists, and we will keep them updated at that point. The call for applications for our summer programs will be coming out soon. And our summer program this year will run from June 9th through 20th.
And how many hours a day are they there during the summer program?
I think they'll be there from 9 a.m. till 3 p.m.
So it's really like camp.
Yes, it's a full day. It's very exciting. So we'll have some things during the day where they're up in the neighborhood, up and walking around looking for data, collecting data. There'll be other times when they'll be on the computer making computer models. It'll be a lot of fun.
Irene Lee, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And Irene Lee and others will be at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers and in a talk entitled Exploring Complex Systems Through Games and Computer Models. And Irene Lee is with the Santa Fe Institute Project Guts. That event is today from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Adios.